The game is on the line, and I've only got a shot clock's worth of time to tell you about Subway's $6.99 footlong deal. That's right. Order now in the Subway app and get any footlong on the menu for just $6.99. Fresh sliced deli meat, fresh crispy veggies. Ah, too much good stuff. Get it now on the Subway app. Any footlong for just $6.99. Use code 699FL now. Only here for a limited time. Redeemable at participating U.S. restaurants. Subway app, online orders only. Add-ons, additional plus tax. Additional fees apply on delivery. Excludes footlong snacks. Limited time.
Gas mark 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. I'm gonna cook a meal that's gonna make you mine. I'm turning up the oven, now we're ready to roast. When you touch me, honey, you'll love me the most. Come on and put me in your loving shoe.
Welcome to another Britflix.com podcast. My name's Stuart Wright, and today's guest is Director of Programming at the Boston Underground Film Festival. Welcome to the show, Nicole McControversy.
Hello.
How the devil are you?
Doing all right, thank you.
Now, listeners, before we get into this, we're going to talk about the Boston Underground Film Festival, but also because Nicole is the Director of Programming, I wanted to pick her brains about the idea of programming a film festival and the kind of reasoning that goes into what I think too many filmmakers obsess about is being about a choice about good over bad, and then thinking if their film doesn't get chosen, somebody is saying their film isn't good, which is far from the truth. I mean, obviously there are abjectly bad things, but that's a whole different other thing if someone's deluded. But when we're talking about rational world, we'll get into some of the whys and wherefores when films get chosen and when films don't get chosen. And then we will talk about three films that have impacted everything in your adult life.
Great. I'm loving it.
And I should say for the audience that I've not said this for a while, actually, when I ask guests to come on and choose three films that have impacted everything in their adult life, I am not for one minute thinking that these are the only three films. I am also not thinking these should be the best films they've ever seen. It is about trying to link our personal biography to films, because we are people that like films and love films. So films must play a role somewhere down the line. And that can just be as simple as, this film changed my outlook on the way I see the world. This film made me think that films can be something else, and so on and so forth. So yes, so that's what I'm asking. It sounds very grand, and it is grand. It's meant to grab the attention. So without further ado, Nicole, let us first address your surname, which I saw in the email, and then I checked the website and it was right. Yes, you are Nicole McControversy. So is that who you are?
Yes, it is who I am. And for the Americans, we'd say McControversy.
Okay.
Just potato, potato kind of thing.
No, please do.
So that really comes from earlier on in my career when I was juggling a day job completely unrelated to film. It was actually, I was working in a church, believe it or not.
Wowza.
And then running an underground film festival by night. So I felt I had these two identities and I needed a slightly different surname to encapsulate the underground part. So McControversy is not too far off from my actual surname and my legal one. So, it just really felt right when I had that moment of clarity. So, and I've just sort of stuck with it since.
And that's the name that's on the website for Boston Underground Film Festival.
Is.
So that's the name I will assume you are known. So first off then, do you want to give people a brief overview as to what Boston Underground Film Festival is and what it's about? I mean, underground in itself is a loaded name when it's within a film festival's title. So tell us more.
Yeah, sure. So I'm not the founder of the festival. It started in 1999 by David Kleiler, who was, so New England, the film scene there is fairly small and very independent. And David realized there was like a gap in, this sort of stuff. So when he started the festival, it was more that traditional term underground, like, you know, George Cukor, and then also kind of just like maybe films in bad taste, I guess you could say,
got you.
Trash, kind of fun stuff like that. And then then there was like a second iteration. So, you know, he took some young up and coming programmers under his wing. They took over, you know, in the early 2000s. I kind of connected with them around that time, a little after. And then just sort of joined the ranks. And then it sort of changed. You know, we've changed a bit in terms of what we see as underground. And so I think my the easiest way for me to describe underground right now is that it's just not mainstream and it's very contextual to the place. So, you know, we have a sister festival in Calgary, Calgary Underground. And then they're very, I would say there's kind of like a spunky independent, you know, spirit to them that's pretty similar to ours and a lot of genre titles. But whereas there's Chicago Underground, which is the oldest underground festival, that festival is very experimental, you know, in its focus. And we don't show a lot of experimental films in Boston these days. And this just all kind of falls to what, you know, audiences are interested in seeing and taking a chance on. So
for the filmmaker out there thinking, you know, I can't get my bloody film into anywhere, or how do you get out, or even the more basic one, how the hell do I get my film into a film festival? What, when you're given, you've given us that context as to what the festival is, that's more than just simply about choosing films, because there is a festival and there's context, as you've just described.
Yes.
So just walk us through some of the basics of sort of how selection works to your mind, and how, when you're programming, what makes a Boston Underground Film Festival film, and what doesn't, maybe?
Yeah, I mean, it's very complex to tease apart. But basically, first, it should be understood that it's not just me choosing things. I work in a team.
Yeah,
we're all volunteers. We all are kind of film obsessed. So we've seen, you know, each of us has seen thousands and thousands of films, like over many, many years. And we have, we still have like a passion for it. You know, like we love it. And the thing that kind of drives us is we're, you know, it's sort of like the thing in show and tell. I don't know if British kids did that in school, but in America, we had show and tell. And I think there's kind of like that in us, essentially. You know, we're just looking for things that we're like, we just have to show other people. That's like the most basic way I could put it. And so, you know, we pour through submissions. We get, you know, around 500 a year, and we look at everything. Multiple people look at everything, and we have a fairly robust spreadsheet. You know, we break it down to, we rate it a little. Everyone has their own sort of personal rating system, and then we have kind of like tags and just sort of different things that, you know, come to the table later when we're narrowing down the pile to what we should seriously consider. And that's going to just really, you know, in one sense, it might depend on what's going on, you know, in a year. You know, that could be politically, that could be kind of in a world zeitgeist sense, or, you know, a national zeitgeist sense, or a city sense, a city zeitgeist sense. So there's kind of like layers upon layers. And these are all the things that are kind of just floating in your head.
Yeah.
Many, many factors, right? While you're just sort of going through things, I feel like, you know that scene in Minority Report where Tom Cruise is like swishing through the digital interface? I feel like that we're doing that sort of with the films as we're sort of considering, you know, we're like kind of...
So in that sense then, you could start off with the 600 submissions between you and the rest of the team, and slowly but surely a theme for the year could emerge that you couldn't have predicted before you started.
Yes, absolutely. And not even so much. So yes, that, but also we will notice themes in the whole body. Yeah. Of the submissions. Hmm. So, you know, it'll be like, something's going on. Like for some reason, there's a lot of clown movies. There's a lot of people working through their clown anxieties this year. That's interesting. Or, you know, like, oh man, like someone really hates dogs this year because there's just like a ton of dog death movies or something, you know, like weird little themes like that. But then there can also be things like anxiety type things, you know, like some years there'll be a lot of films about, you know, expecting parents and things. So it's kind of interesting what pops up, but I feel like it's like part of a, some kind of, if it were its own organism, like the applying the Gaia theory to the body of submissions. Like, there is just sort of personality features of the entity that is the body of submissions.
Now, I know you well enough to know that you can go watch a film just for fun, because we went and watched The Meg at Cineworld one time. So I know that wasn't for work. But obviously, you said at the beginning there that you're all enthusiasts who watch thousands of films over the years. And so each year when you're looking at a new pile of submissions, how are you able to... I'm obsessed with this, with talking to film programmers and distributors and the like. It's like, how do you keep, A, your critical faculties, B, your enthusiasm for film, and then also an eye on the prize, which is we've got to select films for our film festival?
Oh, you know, I mean, I don't know how to answer that. It's just...
Maybe that's the answer.
I don't know.
Maybe that's the answer.
I mean, yeah, I don't know how to answer that. Other than, like, I don't know. It just keeps working. It will work until it breaks, I guess. Like, yeah. I haven't been so broken and bored by films yet that there's nothing to be excited about, you know, still. And I mean, I'm always afraid of that, you know. There's certain points in the year where I'll be, if I'm looking at films in like the mainstream sense, for example, you know, there's very little that's coming to theaters that I'm like super, super excited about, because like I just have very particular tastes, and I get very, you know, like I get bored of things that have been done before. You know what I mean?
Yeah, sure.
That doesn't mean I can't have fun though. And like something that has been done before, if it's done in a way that's just really excellent or really fun, that can also be appreciated. I feel like I'm getting off track with
No, that's good. That's good. I think it's worth sort of understanding that's a dilemma, as much as there's no science to it. It is.
No.
It's a bit, it goes back to your show and tell thing is, you know, I think of like, that's to me, that's, You between you and your team, it's like, oh, I found this nugget of gold amongst the sand, and they go, oh, I found this one. I mean, it's the same as, you know, rocking up to your friends with a new album or a new Blu-ray, going, have you seen or heard this? I mean, but you're doing it in a much mass produced way, because you're having new spreadsheets to keep control of why something's interesting and why something isn't, and those kind of markers, I guess, form patterns that everyone can get on board with without. If it's not too difficult to single out, can you give a couple of examples of sort of films you've programmed that were real sort of like, when you got to watch it, you were like, your heart was singing, going, this is a film for the festival, and then it went through the selection process with the rigors of the rest of the team, and it came out and it got selected. Do you remember a film that you were like, I want to fight for this film and show it?
Yeah, absolutely. The first thing that comes to my mind is from 2018, a criminally underseen film called My Name is Maisha, which had premiered at Slamdance that year. And then we were the second screening. And it is not necessarily something that people would go, that's an underground film. It is about a young Black woman who is killed by the police. And it is sort of this unusual, like, dream musical, beautiful, very theatrical in a lot of ways, just really powerful film. I still get choked up when I start talking about it. It just was so meaningful. It was like, so that's like the first thing. I'm just like, it blew me away.
Yeah.
And I was like, wow. And I cried so hard, and I just felt so many emotions about it. And then I just was like, guys, you got to look at this. Like, drop everything. Everyone look. And everyone had the same reaction.
Oh, wow.
I knew we were really onto something. And so I made the choice that year that had to be the opening film. So where, you know, many festivals would want to have, you know, something very known or something with famous people in it, you know, to open or close a festival, I just felt so strongly about the film that it was like, it has to be the opening film. Has to. So, yes. And that one came through submissions.
Brilliant. Brilliant. So then, just to close then. So we're not here to talk about the festival as it's on this in the coming weeks or whatever. So what time of year can people get to enjoy Boston Underground Film Festival, those that might be able to get there?
Yeah. So it's in Boston. Mm-hmm. It's actually in Harvard Square. That's kind of the fancy part of Cambridge, Boston area. That's going to be March 19th through the 23rd. Mm-hmm. And so we're always around the third week of March. BUFF, that's how we refer to the festival, or Boston Underground. It's a very small boutique kind of festival, I like to call it. You know, it is a single screen, 5 days. We want everyone to see all the films. There are 14 feature films, so very small feature program. We do 6 shorts programs that consists of about 45 short films, plus 25 music videos. We might be the only genre festival that does a dedicated genre music video block as well. So we're very, very friendly to shorts because we know that short filmmakers are the up and coming people, or the people that just must keep creating. You know, they must create art, and we want to have this sort of place for them to exhibit those films, because I believe films should be seen in cinema.
What is it that a short film can do, into your mind, that often feature films obviously can do it, but they don't? 90 minutes plus is not necessarily the best place to experiment with people, whereas 8 to 12 minutes seems like more of a forum to try and play with people. So what for you is it that makes for interesting shorts?
Oh, I mean, like you said, that is the place to experiment. So you can play with an idea without beating it to death or stretching it or bloating it, you know? Like the idea is as it takes as long as it needs, and, you know, it's just compact. And you can just throw so many things that you want to try as a filmmaker into the short film, you know, crazy production design, interesting, you know, sound or music. You know, it's just sort of it's like the sandbox. And I like to play. I think that I'm going to keep coming to this idea throughout this conversation, but I like playfulness and like just, you know, taking risks.
Now, forgive me, because I can't remember the name of it. What was the one you showed us that featured Cannibal Holocaust scoring about 3 times during the process of it?
Okay, so that, what you're thinking of, is called Red Luck. It's by Mike Olenek. He is a Chicago filmmaker. Actually, I saw his work at Chicago Underground many years ago when I went. And yes, Red Luck, very unusual, beautiful film.
Well, look, I'll put links in the show notes to the festival. And then it just gives me to say thank you for sharing that. And we shall move on to 3 films that have impacted everything in your adult life. Now, for listeners that have not heard this before, Nicole has given me 3 films, and I am given a 5 minutes per film to talk about why that film is so memorable. And when the alarm goes off and we hear this sound, that means that we end that chat and move on to the next film. Does that make sense, Nicole?
Yep, got it.
This first film is a 1985 action-adventure film. That's the first full-length clay animation film. A computerized motion-controlled camera system was created just to make the film. It was 3.5 years to make. And even when it was finished in 84, they held it back until 1986 to coincide with the passing of Halley's Comet, which I'm hoping you're going to tell me why that is, because I couldn't work out what that meant. And the director of the film, Will Vinton, voiced several characters but never got credited for one of them. I'm talking about 1985's The Adventures of Mark Twain. So tell me, Nicole, why is this film so memorable and had such lasting impact on you?
Well, I took your instructions to be quite literal, and I gave you these selections in order of effect. And so this is one of the earliest, like, key core memories of my cinematic, you know, journey as a cinephile. And that's one of the first films I saw in a movie theater.
Oh, wow.
So I must have been about 5 or 6.
Do you know what movie theater you saw it in?
I want to say it was in Cahoes in upstate New York.
Okay.
Cool. I don't remember the full, it might have been the Mohawk Mall. It might have been a cinema there.
Okay, go on. Sorry.
And so, this film, I guess first I should say that, like, Will Vinton's claymation is just so iconic for the 80s. And like every kid that grew up at this time, like it's inescapable in America. I don't know how prevalent it was in the UK, but you could not escape this guy's very singular style. You know, it was in movies and commercials, especially. That's okay. Where they got us as kids, commercials, you okay. know? So, you know, he did. No, California reasons.
If I'm representative of the UK, then I don't know this guy. So tell us more.
Just that you're a kid and it's in the 80s and marketing is just so heavily geared towards you and a bombardment. So, you know, I'm sure I saw the style in California Raisins commercials. And then, of course, a little bit later, Domino's Pizza was using his artwork with okay. this thing called the Pizzanoid. But specifically... this film, right? So key memory of just watching it in a cinema. And there's a story, like it's kind of an episodic thing that goes through the different stories that Mark Twain wrote. And and there is one sequence in here very specifically. It's based on Mark Twain's story, The Mysterious Stranger. It is also often cited as just one of those, like, am I allowed to swear?
Yeah.
Fucked up kids movies. Like this is one of the like, quintessential fucked up kids movies and for good reason. So this sequence is about, basically it's about Satan and this like claymation clown face sort of Satan character, and like the kids, you know, Huck Finn and Becky and Tom Sawyer, they like end up, well, they're traveling through the mind of Mark Twain and learning about the stories, and they end up in the mysterious stranger place where they encounter Satan, and they like basically learn some really dark lessons about humanity. And Mark Twain, when he wrote the story, was going through a really dark depression too. So it really comes out in the story, and it's wow. just like Satan is being like, you know, he's got these little guys and he's just making like little people, and it's sort of fun and lighthearted. And then it just gets dark, and something about the vibe of this segment, it just sort of created my it's like the hardware of how I see humanity. I think that this specifically put kind of a nihilistic streak in me. And so, the whole scene, you know, winds up with this sort of idea that, like, you know, humanity is just sort of a waste and whatever, you know, I'll just make some more, you know, humans. And, you know, dark stuff to lay on a 5-year-old.
Yeah. It sounds, it's very different content wise, but Watership Down was the film that brutalized many a UK child when it was repeatedly put on TV and people just couldn't understand that children were expected to watch this. Oh, we are at the end of our first 5 minutes. Well done. Thank you for sharing that. Right then, moving swiftly along to your second choice. Now, the film title is part of our lexicon, I should tell the listener, I think it's safe to say, and requires little, if any, explanation if you put it in the right context. Director Harold Ramis originally wanted Tom Hanks for the lead role, but decided against it because he thought Hanks was too nice. And once shooting the movie, most of the time he would say to Bill Murray, the lead in this film, and Murray, try and explain each scene to him, and Murray would just say, is this good film or bad film? There are exactly 38 days depicted in this film. I'm talking about Groundhog Day from 1993. So tell us, Nicole, how is this film memorable, and what is its impact on you?
So this was the film I was obsessed with in high school. I have probably seen this film more than any other film. I have seen every year on Groundhog Day in the U.S., in certain parts of the U.S., there is a network. I want to say it was USA. Mm-hmm. I can't remember right now, but there's a network that would play the film on a 24-hour loop for the day, and I would like always make sure, like, I was like sick that day or something, so like I could sit and watch it for 24 hours straight. And I did that like every year that you could do that. I did that. Mm-hmm. It was like just my favorite sort of annual little thing. And so I'm very annoying to watch this movie with because I compulsively want to quote along to it because I know pretty much every line of this film. And it also sort of, so I guess this sort of established my sense of humor. You know, I did see it when it first came out, so I must have been like 11, but it really came back in my high school years as just, this is my sense of humor. When I was a young person, just sort of, this is what amused me. You know, and it's all in the details of the film. So I guess I became, this film taught me to become a keen observer. And like, it's all the tiny moments in it, not even like the big funny lines or anything. There's just like very weird little moments in this film that just make me laugh really hard. And so I guess that's sort of the influence that the film had, just sense of humor.
Give us a weird moment that you've honed in on your repeated watches.
Okay, right. Well, so like when Bill Murray is about to rob the bank and he's sort of seen how this all plays out multiple times. So he knows like every step, you know, he's doing like this countdown as he's crossing the street, you know, and it starts off and he's just like, gust of wind, a dog barking, cue the truck, you know, like these are funny to me. Like, I just find it so funny. You know, what else? Just like Bill Murray, just doing the delivery of certain lines, you know, just, you know, too early for flapjacks. So funny that he blinks twice very rapidly when he says it. Hilarious. So, yeah, I mean, I guess I sound like a crazy person trying to explain why I think it's funny. It's either funny to you or it's not. You know, there's a lot of other things in the film that are funny, but it's just all these weird little tiny things, the details for me that make the movie very funny beyond the writing, which is also very
In getting ready for today, I found out that, and I never know, I've not watched it as much as you have, I wouldn't claim, but I've certainly watched it a few times. I've even, as a screenwriter, I've took it apart to see why it works, you know, to look at such a great model. And I never noticed in those repeat watchings that in the diner scenes, all the clocks are stopped.
Yes.
Which is such a nice touch, you know. Obviously, nobody's really going to notice that, but the idea of putting that into the story, and while it's not similar to what you were talking about before with the darkness and things, but you know, Groundhog Day can be read quite the dark film. And reading about Danny Rubin's original script, you know, they got rid of the homicide and the rape and everything that was sort of this idea of what you could get away with if.
Yes.
I mean, that's a very different film.
Definitely. And, you know, in a lot of ways, there's kind of a Satan element here, too. Mm. Like, because there's also this, like, very funny theory that, you know, he's in hell / limbo. And, you know, Ned Ryerson's the devil. And so, like, there's kind of funny, you know, reads on this little universe that he's stuck in. So maybe there is a thing there between the last film I mentioned and this film. I don't know, there might be like a devil thing going on there. But also it's
finish your thought, the bell.
I was just gonna say, like, you know, it is like the godfather of time loop movies, and who doesn't love a time loop movie? And for so many reasons, which that could be another conversation for another day, but time loops.
Just one last thing though, from a woman's point of view, and the whole idea of where it ends, where he manages to woo the woman, having tried in umpteen different ways, which are wholly inappropriate, but he learns. Obviously, she only knows in terms of the time of the movie, the one version she falls for. The other ones don't exist, do they? Which is the kind of... But if you step back from it, it's weird as hell to think that he went through all those versions of himself.
Yes. I mean, well, because he, you know, initially he was approaching it and he was trying so hard. And, you know, that's why it wasn't working, because he was trying too hard, you know, to make it too perfect. And like, it had to just kind of come naturally. And that's why the final successful version of him was able to win her over, because there was a genuineness. Whether that, you know, translates to something someone could do in a real sense, I don't know. Yeah, there's creepy parts of that film.
Well, but given how many days, I mean, somebody was saying that to play the piano to the level he was at, that's at least 10,000 days or something that he's clearly repeated. So although the film might show 38, he's lived a lot more. Right then, we shall move on to your third and final choice, which is described on IMDb as a dark comedy, farce, supernatural horror. It's from Japan, I should add. What amazed me was this film was commissioned by a Japanese studio in response to the success of foreign horror films like Jaws, which I don't understand as a comparable. None of the seven women in the film were trained actors. They were all models who'd worked with the director in commercials. I'm talking about 1977's House. Would you like to tell us where this film sits in your film watching biography and why it impacted on you?
Sure. And so I joined Buff in 2008.
Okay.
You know, I as a volunteer, just sort of new to the whole scene, like, what is a film festival? I don't know. I'm figuring it out as I go along, learning from, you know, my mentor. And I have a friend who... Basically, I like to have friends who have just better taste and more interesting taste than me. And I like to surround myself with people like that.
Mm-hmm.
Like, those are the people to learn from, right?
So indeed.
I believe I first found out about this film on like Instagram or Facebook. Maybe it was Facebook. I don't think Instagram existed. An artist friend of mine named Lee Noble had posted a still of this on something.
Yeah.
And it caught my eye and I thought, what is that? I need to know what that is. And so I tracked it down. I tracked down a bootleg. I got a copy of the film and I just watched it because I thought that just looks really cool. And I was so like not prepared for what this film is and what it, you know, does. You know, I just never seen anything like it. And I guess I think I credit this film with converting me from like a more passive beginner programmer to an obsessed person chasing a high, like for the rest of my life, because all I've ever wanted is to experience that again. Aww. For the first time. And that is what I chase. That's like my, obviously, you know, finding the next house to, like, and that doesn't mean it's exactly like house to, how it made me feel, you know? So, this film did that for me, and I showed it to, you know, my then boss at Buff, and I was like, we must show this. And so we did end up showing it, I want to say in 2009, and it was actually just right before that rediscovery, that huge wave of rediscovery that film
Right. I was going to say, you're right in line. I mean, apparently, you know, it was commercial and critical success in Japan, but rarely seen in the States until 2009.
Yeah. And then like 2008, Cine Family had shown it. And that was the, like, so I was like, guys, what do I do? How do I make this happen? So those guys helped me at the right time. I think it was Brett at Cine Family, who's, you know, a million years ago, Cine Family.
Do you want to talk to some of the aesthetics of this film? Why it's a film you might want to chase the high of? What is it? What has it got that not every film's got for you?
You know what it has? It has the mind of a 7-year-old girl. That's what it has. It is just completely untethered to the rules, you know, that more formal cinema demands. You know, I like, there's a playfulness to it. It is very playful. The logic doesn't have to make sense, but it still works. And I find it visually inventive and just funny. It's just funny. And maybe it just makes me laugh, make my internal 7-year-old girl laughs along with the, like, kind of horrific, but it still feels safe and funny, you know?
Mm-hmm.
It's like, you know, Mac's head flying off and like trying to bite the girl at the well. That's funny and gruesome. Love it. You know, it's like the cat constantly coming in and fucking shit up, and all the different, you know, ways we see that cat and like the kind of weird art that's sort of reminiscent of that of art, that LSD guy, you know, who did the cat paintings.
Yeah, yeah.
In the 60s, you know, it's like the psychedelic nature of a lot of just the art in this film. Now, it just really speaks to me.
No. Oh, there goes our alarm. But just let me, it's fascinating that you said it sort of, it feels like it comes from the mind of a 7-year-old. Did you know that it was inspired by a conversation with his 12-year-old daughter?
Yeah, that's
she,
it.
She said to him that she had a fear of a mirror that was going to eat her. And that became the director's sort of inspiration for the film.
Yes, that it just totally tracks, you know. And he's also, you know, I've since tracked down some of the commercials that he did, and there is just such a playful spirit to his work, and he seemed like someone so open to anything, uh-huh. and like just exploring, you know, and playing, you know. So I think that's why his work really appeals to me.
Well, look, thank you for sharing three films that have impacted everything in adult life. And thank you for giving us an insight into Boston Underground Film Festival. It's been a treat.
Thank you.